Thank you for joining us. This is Clinical Conversations podcast number 134. We're part of Journal Watch, which tracks new research for working clinicians. Its website is jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. Joining me is co-host Dr. Danielle Schurer of the Medical University of South Carolina. A study from Denmark this week calls into question the need for continuing surveillance in patients with a condition known as Barrett's esophagus who do not have accompanying dysplasia. The investigators used data from the Danish National Pathology Registry to identify a cohort of some 11,000 people with Barrett's, and then used the Danish Cancer Registry to identify members of that cohort who received a diagnosis of esophageal adenocarcinoma or high-grade dysplasia during a median follow-up of roughly 5 years. The risks for adenocarcinoma were indeed found to be higher with Barrett's than in the general population, but the risks were much lower than previous estimates. Our guest this time is the paper's first author, Dr. Frederik Vidjensen of the Department of Surgical Gastroenterology at Aarhus University in Denmark. Welcome, Dr. Vidjensen.
Yes, hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I wanted to ask, should Barrett's esophagus no longer be considered a precursor to esophageal adenocarcinoma, or is that overstating the case?
That would be to overstate the case. Barrett's esophagus is still the most important risk factor for esophageal adenocarcinoma. But it seems like the risk is overestimated at the moment.
In your paper, you found the presence of low-grade dysplasia increased the risk of developing adenocarcinoma by about fivefold, but those were not nearly as high as previous estimates. Can you give our audience an idea about how much lower the new estimates are?
Roughly, the new estimates are around five times lower compared to previous studies and also previous meta-analysis. And the risk has been falling the last decade, but at the moment the risk is estimated five times higher than what we find.
So it was interesting. You also found that about two-thirds of the new adenocarcinoma diagnoses were found within the first year of follow-up. And I was very struck by that high number and wanted to see if you could also comment a little further on that.
Yeah, that's actually a really, really important finding, because that's a really take-home message for the clinicians, that when you find a new patient with Barrett's esophagus, then you would expect to find two-thirds of the new adenocarcinomas within the first year. So that's important when you try to find the patients that you should do surveillance on and the patients you don't do surveillance on, that you within the first year do really thorough, maybe two or three endoscopies to rule out.
You also discuss about how we've sort of always assumed that the progression of this was that it progresses from Barrett's to low-grade dysplasia, to high-grade dysplasia, to adenocarcinoma, sort of in that order. But even that is really hard to prove, right?
Yeah, it is extremely difficult to prove. It is a well-known fact among pathologists that everybody knows that dysplasia is not like like pushing a button and saying it's there, it's not there. It's, mm-hmm. it's a number of characteristics within the cells that that needs to be identified, and then when you kind of score enough points, then you say this is low grade or this is high grade. Mm-hmm. But still, there's like a, almost like flip a coin inter-observer agreement when you do studies if you have the same biopsy, and then you have several pathologists look at the same biopsy, you will actually have very little inter-observer agreement. So you can actually see that in many patients, when for instance they have low-grade dysplasia found, then the follow-up endoscopies, they will not maybe find the mm-hmm. low-grade,
and that might be. It's not necessarily that it's not there. It's just that you didn't find it.
Maybe you just didn't take the right biopsy, or maybe the new pathologist or the same pathologist don't grade the cells the same way as last time. So that's a problem, but it's still the best biomarker that's available.
And so if there was a primary care doctor or gastroenterologist reading your paper, what would you suggest that they do as far as adjusting their surveillance practices based on your findings?
We would suggest that that you do a thorough investigation in this new Barrett patient and rule out that they have dysplasia. And that would be maybe doing at least two endoscopies within the first year. And if the patient doesn't have any kind of dysplasia, then you should really consider if you want to do any surveillance further on. And if the Barrett's patient has dysplasia, then we would recommend more or less to follow the guidelines that are today to do follow-up further on. And that's actually, if you do it in numbers, it's our study shows that it's actually less than 10% of this Barrett cohort that develops dysplasia within our follow-up period. So you actually have 90% of the Barrett patients that will never develop any dysplasia. Mm-hmm. So you could say potentially 90% of the Barrett patients, if you want to do a little provocative statement, and 90% might not need the surveillance that we're doing today.
I wanted to ask if for a primary care clinician, how might they reassure their patients with Barrett's esophagus in the light of your findings?
That's the tricky part, because of course you can't make any promises that they are not developing any cancer, because I mean statistically they could be in the right group, or they could be in the small group that actually develops further progression. It's a tough call how to make it, but I think you should, as a clinician, put forward the numbers that the risk for Barrett developing any further neoplasia is rather small. But still, as we find also, the risk among Barrett's patients is still 11 times higher compared to the background population.
It used to be estimated at something like 40 and 80 times higher than the background, but that's no longer true according to your findings and according to the findings from the Northern Ireland cohort. Is that right?
Yeah.
So it's still a little tricky, again, because it sounds like we still don't really know who will and who will not progress. It sounds like we need a little more research in that area to figure out if there's some kind of markers to predict who does and who.
Yeah, and luckily there is a lot of research going on trying to find more reliable biomarkers, whether that's within the biopsies or blood samples or genetics, to see if we can identify some high-risk patients within these various patients. But it's still there's no better option than doing the dysplasia. So actually, yeah, we need better biomarkers, but we haven't found them yet.
Okay.
And the only biomarker, or the only marker that you have now is endoscopy, but I'm sure you read the editorial about your paper in the New England Journal, and he seems to make a case that that you shouldn't do routine endoscopy in patients with frequent heartburn, because those endoscopies often lead to findings of Barrett's esophagus, and he says that those findings are less and less important prognostically. Did you agree with that?
I mean, you don't. If you do continuous endoscopies and you just continue finding Barrett's, then that doesn't help you much. But of course, if you find the patient has dysplasia, then you should continue doing your surveillance as we have done so far. But still, you need to do within Barrett's patients, within a cohort, you need to do around 1,000 endoscopies to find one cancer. Mm. And that's if you actually find the cancer every time. There's no room for not biopsying the right place. So 1,000 endoscopies is quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So your advice then is to do if a patient has got Barrett's, to do a thorough investigation perhaps two endoscopies in the first year just to rule out that they don't either have a cancer or that they don't have a worrisome dysplasia.
Good. That would be the recommendation. It's not written into any guidelines, but as you said, our study really highlights that this should maybe be the new guidelines, and also the Northern Ireland study that is very similar to our study. They have a little bit smaller cohort, but their findings, the risk estimates, is more or less the same as the ones we have.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Dr. Vigensen, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Nice talking to you.
Excellent. Thanks.
That was our 134th edition. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Ador Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time for myself and Dr. Danielle Schurer. Thank you for listening.